My name is Shredda, and this is The Lightner Side of Things, Practitioner Perspectives in School Psychology, a place for school psychology practitioners to come together and share experiences and insights about their work. I am talking with Dr. Andrea Klein. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. How are you?
Great, thank you. Thank you so much for joining me today to talk about your work and your career and what things look like as a practitioner for you.
Thank you for having me today.
Of course. So you've been a school psychologist for 24 years. You've seen quite an evolution, I'm sure, throughout the years. Can you talk a little bit about kind of how you got started in the career and talk about that evolution that you've seen?
Yes, absolutely. And I've actually been working for 30 years, believe it or not. I think it's hard to believe that I've been working in this career for 30 years. And I felt so fortunate that I was able to find this option in life right out of grad school. I started in 1990, and my first 15 years or so of my career, I worked in a traditional role of school psychology, which I definitely enjoyed. This involved a lot of evaluations, counseling, direct services, mental health services, and consultation. But I'd say it was pretty heavy on the evaluation side. And my role sort of evolved midway through my career as IDEA was reauthorized in 2004, which emphasized and went along nicely with the idea of a more broad-based role in school psychology. And so the second half of my career has almost felt like a different career because I have been able to embrace a broader role slowly but surely, which goes along with the NAS practice model.
Yeah, sure. How has your daily practice been impacted by that evolution, by especially that second half where you said it felt like a completely different career?
Well, you know, it's funny. I sort of fell into it accidentally, I'd say, because I was working in several schools, but in one school in particular, where the principal and I had developed a strong working relationship. And we were both very interested in some of the elements of the reauthorization that allowed us to provide some services outside of special education. And we were both interested in finding ways to help students to achieve academically with or without an IEP. And so we kind of through trial and error started working on some different practices in our school. This is a middle school, by the way, where we would be able to provide some extra supports and services to students without an IEP. And so this was kind of in line with RTI ideas. And by engaging in that work with him and then with other school leaders, that kind of led to the next thing and then the next thing, which really, if you think of it all together, I was knee deep in efforts at school improvement. And I think just by broadening my lens a bit to the whole school, that really helped my day-to-day life to change. So I've always enjoyed evaluation. It's really fascinating. And I think it can be really helpful for a lot of students to have that information, that cognitive information. But I was finding, well, and social emotional, that social emotional evaluation piece as well. But I was finding that I was doing so many evaluations earlier in my career that I kind of had to keep my head down and focus on that just to keep up with the pace and keep up with the volume. And I really didn't have the opportunity to look beyond my office that much, which was discouraging for me because it seemed like there was no end in sight with all the evaluations. So when the opportunity came to partner with this principal and with some other interested parties in the school about how we might be able to change our intervention programs, if you will, and our ways of supporting students from low-income backgrounds and the like, it really sparked more hope in me. And it was very exciting to be able to broaden my view a bit and to step outside my office, if you will. So that kind of work. Oh, in conjunction, I should say, I think my interest also really grew after attending just my state association convention every year, conference every year in Colorado. And I would listen to these national level speakers and got very inspired by what I learned. One of those topics was the research that came out in the early 2000s about learning disabilities and dyslexia, and how it wasn't necessarily this sort of death sentence in terms of the ability for children to ever get better at their reading skills. And the idea that with early intervention and intensive intervention, we could not only improve students' reading skills, but we could really change the brain. That I found very fascinating. And I worked with some other school psychologists in my district to form a little informal study group. And we, in our nerdily little way, would go to the library, and this is pre, times of the internet providing everything that we could ever need. And we would print out articles and share them and things. So part of my journey has definitely been finding other people who are interested in these things. And we learned about these things, and then we tried to start implementing some interventions in our school buildings to address the reading deficits that we were seeing around us. And long story short, we tried to craft our own RTI practices, and I cannot say that they were fantastic. But I think what it did was it allowed myself and other people to see that we might be able to do things differently. And reach greater numbers of students. So, let's see, I'm getting into the weeds here, but I think this type of work led to also trying to implement PBIS and working on RTI practices and PBIS sort of threw me into working in a broader role. And at the beginning of both of these efforts, I definitely felt burdened at times with my regular school psychology duties and my interest. It was almost like a professional hobby, my interest in these topics and in working at trying to improve our school programming and things like that. But over time, we saw, and as our district and our state and the national conversation moved towards a more broad-based role, we saw that the work we put in at the school level and the systems level was it was definitely paying off, and we were finding that more students were being helped by these MTSS processes, and this was resulting in less special ed evaluations. And that was very exciting. And, whenever you start to get some success in anything, it really is very reinforcing. And that just led us to keep working on these things. So I have a strong passion for the practice model. I was the practice model chair of the practice model committee at NASP for a few years. And I really believe in this work. And when the standards were revised in 2010, I think that was a really important time also because of how well it was crafted into this model. And it was really communicated well, I think, to school psychologists across the country about, hey, you can have this expanded role, and these are some of the things you can do. And one of those sets of areas and domains is the systems level work, and the consultation piece as well that both really resonated with me, and that's kind of how my role has transformed through the years. So I hope that that's not too much information for you, but that's kind of in a nutshell what my career has transformed from the early days of a more traditional role into a bit of a more expanded role. And it's something that I don't think I've ever completely mastered, but the nice thing about the practice model is it gives us so many different areas to work on and to focus on.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so wonderful to hear from someone who is so experienced, and has been through so much in the field, and the work you've done, how it's had such a long-term impact. But it struck me that you talked about how when you started and started implementing these interventions and that process, that it definitely was not perfect. It maybe didn't look great. And it reminded me of, a few days ago when we talked, you said something that kind of stuck with me. You said you don't have to be perfect to make change. And I think that's such an important lesson to take away that, we all want to do the best we can for our students. And in that, I think we strive to get everything right. And sometimes we just have to trust the process and do the best we can, but keep moving forward.
Exactly. I feel very strongly about that. I think most people who get into our field are very conscientious people, and who want to do things right. And we are very mindful about implementation fidelity. We're very mindful about program evaluation and those things that, have us focus on our things being done correctly. And I think that that's really important to do. For ourselves, though, I think that you can't be super successful in this field and be a perfectionist. That's not to say that you shouldn't be careful and detail oriented, because that's crucial, particularly when we're evaluating children, for instance. We have to double and triple check our work because, as you miss a detail, and that can mean a lot of different things for a student. But I mean, in our broader role, you can't be a perfectionist, because then you can't get anything done. That perfectionism can be such a huge roadblock to progress. And I think that it's important to know that we're all going to make mistakes. We're all going to swing and miss sometimes. And that feels terrible when that happens. But I also think that it means that you are moving forward and you're trying things. And so, as somebody who I guess I would call myself a former perfectionist when I was younger, I've learned how to embrace all the mistakes that I've made, because I see that that's part of the process of trying to create change, and trying to be a change agent involves making those mistakes. So we do the best we can. I say these kinds of things to interns every year. We're working in public education. It is a very noble profession. Any educator, I think, is doing tremendous things just being in the profession and trying to help society this way. But we have to know that there are so many barriers that we work on, we chip away at them, and we just do the best we can.
And it also brings up the issue of school psychologist shortages, which I know you've been very vocal about. Putting school psychologists into that MTSS or PBIS work is really important. But that said, the laws, the federal and state regulations still require special education evaluations and testing, and specifically identify school psychologists in that language. We know as caseloads increase that it's not always feasible for school psychologists to do both. What does that shortage look like in your area? And how is that the shortages, how have they impacted your practice?
So I'm so interested in all of those pieces of what you just said. I want to start with how the shortages affect our work and how difficult it can be to try to do it all. Especially if you are in a region or a district where the evaluation load is so heavy and you're bound by laws and practices that require you to complete all of these. I think it's extremely difficult. I can speak from my experience in being in buildings where I have very little time to buildings where I have a lot of time. And there's no doubt that that time element does change things in terms of how involved you can be in a broader way in the school. In Colorado, we have some tremendous shortages in different pockets of the state, particularly in the rural areas, which I think is the case across the country. We have such a crisis in our rural areas with not enough school psychologists. I think that and in particular where I work, I compared to so many school psychologists, I'm doing pretty well. I think my ratio this year is around 1 to 900, something like that. It's been as low as 1 to 700 before, and it kind of fluctuates depending on the year-to-year FTE. I've found, though, even in schools where I've only been there a half a day or a day, while I haven't been able to have the same kind of influence that takes time to develop through developing those relationships and the like, and to work into more of a leadership role. There, I think I have a couple of ways that school psychologists can broaden their role a little bit. And these aren't earth-shattering ideas in any way, but I've found that when I take the time to spend time with the principal or the leadership team, even if it's not that often. But when I'm able to have those conversations, I'm able to listen and learn about what their vision is for the school, find out what's important to them and the kinds of school improvement goals that they have. And then I can look for ways or areas, I can look at areas that I might be able to help with. It might even come down to a few comments about, have you considered this or the other idea? Sharing journal articles that might resonate or might have to do with something that they brought up that's important to them. Having those broader conversations and being able to speak about issues that speak to the health of the whole school, I think really I've found that principals find that to be valuable, and they then sometimes ask me to be involved in other meetings or other committees, things like that. So just even carving out a little time for some meetings where people are talking about problems at the school level, the system level, I feel like that can add value. And I feel that principals respond well to that. It's worked pretty well for me, not with every principal, but with most, I'd say. They appreciate the sounding board. They appreciate the school psychologist as consultant who can find out more information or provide research related to questions that they have, and who can problem solve with them on issues such as absenteeism or chronic underachievement. So that's kind of how I have approached so far schools where I don't have very much time with them. I try to be at the table where some of the big problems are being discussed. Now, having said that, I think when school psychologists are in districts or states where there's a very heavy evaluation load, I think it's important to try to, again, carve out time. And that's easier said than done. I completely understand that. But to carve out time to look at the broader intervention programs in the school, try to analyze the health of those programs. Are they working? Do they need help? Because as MTSS measures improve, as classroom instruction improves, and as school climate improves, I think you really see a decrease in the pressure that's put on special education. And that health of the broader school also spills into the health or the lack of health in the special ed programming. So I guess what I'm talking about is I'm a huge proponent of prevention programs. I know from experience that they work, and they do require work to get them started or to restart them or to improve practices within them. But I have found that all the hours that go into that really do save hours on the other end most of the time.
That's great advice. I really like that recognition that the health of the whole school is linked to an emphasis on special education, or how much that school emphasizes special education.
Yes, I mean, they all go together, right? I know that education, like many organizations, can become very siloed in our efforts. But I find that when schools work in silos, the dysfunction just grows, right? And the communication between people just doesn't work very well. So I think I've probably sat in enough meetings in my lifetime and in my career, you know, we all get tired of meetings. I also recognize, boy, those meetings are so important in being able to find time to talk with one another from different perspectives and different lenses. That's so critical. One, we have to understand one another. I need to understand what it's like to be a teacher, for instance. I need to really understand what the administrators, the principals are going through, and vice versa. And I think once people understand each other better, and they develop those strong collegial relationships, that's when really beautiful things can happen. Because when we're striving alongside other people who have similar goals for improving the school and improving outcomes for students, I believe then we can learn from each other, and we can make the work lighter by sharing that burden.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about some of the racial tensions and increased awareness of social justice issues that we're nationally going through at the moment.
Okay.
In what ways have your perspective or priorities as a practitioner shifted in this current climate?
Excellent question. I think it's been such an incredible year, such a painful year for so many people, for so many Americans, for so many families and children. I think that sadness has really struck me. And I think, like many people, many white people, I have wanted to understand that better. I've wanted to understand what it's like for people of color to experience everything that's been going on, all the violence, the injustices that have been really magnified for everyone at the same. So I've been doing my own study. I've been listening to colleagues. I've been listening to people who know more about these perspectives and know more about systemic racism than me. And I've been trying to learn as much as I can. I think, like many, probably most, if not all school psychologists, I am a very sensitive person. I think that drew me to this field. So I've felt like I've always been sensitive to issues around race and racism. And at the same time, I've learned that I have my own biases, my own implicit biases. And through some work I've been involved in with NASP at the board of directors level over the last few years, I've learned more about my implicit biases. And I think that that's been so important. And it makes me want to shout from the rooftops, everybody needs to go through implicit bias training, you know. So with this summer and with this year, I've been reflecting on what I'm learning from others, what I'm learning from colleagues and friends of color, from Black people that I've learned about through personal connections with them or through reading. I've really been thinking about how this extends to all people of color in some ways as well. In my schools, Hispanics, Latinx population is the largest minority group, minoritized group. And I've been conscious of the achievement gaps and some of the other disparities that have been going on for a number of years. And this just magnified my lens around that this summer. This work is ongoing, and I know that last school year, one of my schools focused on our school climate for all children, and this is something that most schools engage in, this kind of work, looking at their school climate. However, we found that our white students were really feeling a lot better about school than our non-white students. And this really rocked us because we were not aware of that. We thought that we knew all of our kids so well. And this is very troubling for us. So we're engaging, we're taking next steps in trying to learn more about what each student's experience is like. And we engaged in some focus groups to listen to the students and learn from them. I feel like this kind of work needs to be encouraged, and we need to spend more time doing this kind of work so that we can help all students to feel a true belonging at their schools. We have problems with disproportionality in discipline in our country, as well as in my local area. We have disparities around special education evaluations, around disproportionality in students who qualify for special education. So there's so much work to be done. And I'm grateful that as a field, we all have embraced this work through our social justice strategic goal and through our standards. I think that if school psychologists don't know how to get involved in this. I think the first thing to do is to try to learn as much as possible and then be present at the school, be present in faculty meetings, really be ready to provide your perspective when people are looking at data, and look for ways to advocate and be a voice for those students and those groups who don't always find their own voice. I think it's important for us to not only advocate for those groups of students and individual students, but also help them to find their voice and teach kids how to advocate for themselves, how to ask for what they need, and how to ask questions when they think something's unfair. So, advocacy is something that I think all school psychologists need to learn more about and learn how to do, because it's so empowering when we can help students learn to find their own voices and their parents and communities.
And one of the NASP practice model domains is equitable practices for diverse student populations, as you're well
Yes.
aware. This domain emphasizes having an understanding of diversity, cultural competency, and it also makes that distinction between equality and equity. As a more experienced practitioner, do you feel that your comfort level in this area or your skills have increased over time? Do you feel sort of more comfortable?
Yes, I do, and I think it's really just from being open to learning. I think that I can't tell you how much I've learned from other people from over the years. I've had the great opportunity to take advantage of so much professional development in this area as a practitioner. And then in my role as a volunteer leader in my state association and in the national organization in NASP. And just it's just amazing to me when I think about how powerful knowledge is, quite simply, just learning from others and reading and reaching a richer understanding of what equity means is so powerful. And then when I'm in real life situations where there are problems and there are big discussions about these issues, I am able to engage in those conversations better because I understand better. You know what I mean? It's just so, it sounds so simple, but it kind of is simple in terms of what we can provide at a beginning level is through our consultation and through our relationships with families and with school leaders and with teachers and students, we can engage. And I think it's that engagement that's the most important thing, because once we're at the table, then we can provide information, we can provide insight, and we can ask questions that hopefully will improve the conversation or enhance the conversation around equity and talking about what students need, and provide services based on what they need, not necessarily exactly the same as what every student gets. That whole distinction between equality and equity. I feel like I'm more comfortable with this as a veteran, but I feel like that comfort level can come early in someone's career if they're willing to learn more about this and willing to engage in those conversations and those relationships with others in the school community.
The reason I asked that question is because a lot of early career practitioners, especially, will ask, I went to this PD, but I still feel so uncomfortable. There's a discomfort in engaging in those conversations or, addressing those issues. So I like that you emphasize that it is a process and you can get there, but it's always going to be a process. It's a process for everyone. It's a constant learning and engagement process.
Exactly. And I think as an early practitioner, one thing I might think about is how developing a good relationship with your principal or principals, depending on how many schools you're serving, is crucial, so that with a positive, respectful working relationship as a foundation, you can always set an appointment with your principal if there's something going on that you don't feel comfortable speaking about in a with a broader group yet. You can always talk to your principal about something that's bothering you, something that you've noticed, something that you observe. And I think that having those kinds of conversations that can be challenging at times are crucial. And lots of times, I believe those kinds of conversations will resonate with principals, and maybe they were thinking the same thing, but didn't know where to start. So there can be power just in having those conversations. And again, it's kind of like finding like-minded people who want to work on a problem, just as an idea of how to get started. If there's something going on that really seems wrong, I think it's important to talk to someone. And who better than your principal or some other leader that can help join with you in working on the problem.
I like that. So I want to pull out one of your quotes or something you've stated when running for the NASP delegate position, and you responded to a question about how you would use your position to promote NASP priorities. And you talked about the importance of advocacy before, so this is very much in line with that. You said, "I have very strong feelings about the need to help school psychologists realize their leadership potential so that they will regularly work side by side with district and school leaders in order to help not only students, but also schools as a whole to thrive." So how can practitioners realize their leadership potential and use it in a way that really influences change in their buildings?
That's
big question.
Okay. Thanks for bringing that up. I'm flattered that you grabbed that quote for me. So I believe that some of the things I've been talking about in terms of systems level change, I believe that that requires leadership. And it's not like you can just blink your eyes and wish it to happen. I know it sounds kind of daunting maybe at times for people, but I believe that leadership grows in subtle ways. And I've always felt that relationships are the foundation for everything. And I've talked a little bit about that already. But finding and creating those connections, to quote the great John Kelly, a NASP past president, is very important. Creating connections, forming respectful, collegial relationships with others in the schools is critical. And you can't really be a good leader without them, I don't believe. Finding ways to support others is a path to leadership. I've always thought of myself as someone who supports other people, whether it's the teachers that I work with, the special ed teachers, the principals, the counselors. I guess I have sort of what resonates with me is a servant type of leadership that has fit my personality. If I find ways to help other people, to support them, that creates a positive feeling for them. And that strengthens my relationship with them. And that, I believe that's kind of like having money in the bank, so that if I need to remove a little bit of that, for instance, if I'm asking something of them, if I'm asking them and encouraging them to do something differently, then I've got that deposit in the bank to draw from with that positive relationship. So being a supporter of others, working on my relationships, and then really trying hard to solve problems that we're all facing, but being a good problem solver, and it's part of supporting others. If I can successfully enhance problem solving or come up with good ideas that we can use as a school to solve some tough problems or to at least chip away at them, people start seeing me as a leader. And then if I'm willing to communicate about some of those things to others, for instance, if I'm asked to provide some professional development about a topic, or if I volunteer to provide professional development to the school or the district, then people see me as a leader. So there are some very kind of subtle and practical things that school psychologists can do to develop these leadership skills. Some people call these soft skills, but I really think of it more as opportunities. Look for opportunities to help, to volunteer, to say something meaningful about a topic, to communicate about areas of interest that are related to some of these larger educational goals or school improvement goals. People start seeing you as a leader when you help out, and when you follow through. Sometimes it's as simple, I swear, I have fallen into so many leadership opportunities that I really didn't think I deserved, simply by following through and being responsible and finishing things, doing things that I said I would do. I don't think that leadership just happens magically. I think people, if you're doing these things well, people just see you as a leader because you're following through and you're trying to help others and you're trying to help the greater good in the school.
Do you feel like those three things, building those relationships, being a problem solver, and kind of making sure we're following through, that those things may help sort of maybe when there is a disagreement at the table and maybe there's tensions because of a disagreement, those things help because there's an underlying understanding that we're all there with the same ultimate goal in mind. We're all there for the students' best interests.
Yeah, you are absolutely right. I'm sitting over here chuckling a little bit because that's such an important point. If you ask anybody who knows me well, you would know that there have been many real life examples of this in my work. I think that I've grown into that advocacy role just through the kinds of things we've been talking about today. And I have many examples of times with principals I've worked with, for instance, who I've had an excellent relationship with, and we have disagreed about things. And that's putting it lightly at times. We've gotten into some pretty heated battles, I'd say, but between friends, between colleagues. And it's so true that there's no way I can have those kinds of conversations go well unless we have a good relationship. And this is with other leaders too, at the state level, at NASP level. We're passionate people and we fight for what we think is important. And we are more successful with those things when we have developed a strong relationship and when we've earned respect and trust. And those things are critical for change to happen successfully.
Wonderful. You've given so much great advice already, but I'm going to ask anyway if you have any other advice you would give to less experienced practitioners.
I think it's important to know that the field of school psychology, not only is it an incredible field full of opportunities and possibilities, and I want to plug our President Wendy Price's theme for her presidential year, which is the power of possibility. While we have that, we have such a broad practice model. It's so rich with so many opportunities to support and help children and schools. I think we also have to know and face the fact that it's very easy to get overwhelmed because of that. And I think that that is why some people fall into a narrower role, even when it is possible to expand the role. For new practitioners, I recommend that they set goals each year for one or two things. And this falls in line with how most personnel evaluations go, which is good, is we choose one or two things a year to focus on in our practice or to learn more about. And we take one or two steps every year to try to make progress on those goals, knowing that there's so much that we can do, but no one is expected to do it all the time. That's just not realistic. So to set small goals and to be remaining open to the possibilities as they come up, I would advise people to, like I said, work on their relationships, work on earning a positive reputation. Try to help out wherever you can. Our motto is we're here to help. And that is so wise, I have to say. If we remain open to wanting to help wherever it comes from, we are going to reap dividends from that with our relationships. I also think it's really important to try to have fun where you can. Have fun with kids. We're so lucky we have this career where we get to be silly and goofy with kids. I think that's probably sustained me for so many years, is I get to have fun with kids. I love forming those relationships with students where hopefully, ultimately, they feel very well understood by me, and we can cut up, we can be silly, we can have fun. So don't forget to have fun and don't try to be perfect. Embrace the probability that you're going to make mistakes and accept it and almost see it as progress. You make a mistake, that's something you can learn from, and that's something that maybe was necessary on the road that you're on. But to hang in there also and not get discouraged. And I want to quote Lisa Kelly. Boy, I have so much respect, I'm realizing, for these wise people who have been presidents in terms of self-care. It's really important to take care of yourself. We carry a lot of sadness, and we carry a lot of stress as we absorb this from the people we work with and the students we work with. So take care of yourselves. Shout out to Leslie Page too, with her leadership theme last year. These are all great themes for us, and try to be inspired by others. If you get overwhelmed, take a step back, take care of yourself, and take some time to look at examples of other people and let them inspire you while you're tired and while you're recuperating. But to hang in there, it's a wonderful career. And we need everyone to stay in it, be in it to win it. We can't lose anybody right now. There's so much to do. So I guess that would be it for me.
It's all such great advice. I think it's the first time I've ever heard anyone say to me, don't forget to have fun. So I really appreciate that.
Boy, that's terrible, isn't it? We all get so mired in all the problems, but it's so much fun to spend time with kids, isn't it?
It absolutely is. We can't forget that. Right. We can't lose that. Lastly, I always like to ask this question as well. What advice would you give to graduate training programs to help them better prepare their school psychology students, especially in today's social and political climate?
That's an excellent question, too. I think what comes to mind first is that I think it's a lot of what we've been talking about this last hour has to do with things that you might not have a course on, but it's the communication skills, leadership skills, some of these soft skills that I believe students oftentimes need more access to, examples of how to do this type of work. Mental and behavioral health services. I think it would be great if there was additional emphasis on varied models and then varied and increased practice with this kind of work. How to provide practical services in the schools around mental and behavioral health needs. So if that could be emphasized, I think that that would help students and new practitioners to feel more comfortable in this work in the schools. I'm excited about the passage of the 2020 standards. I think the standards and the practice model contains a lot of different examples of the type of work that can be done in all the domains. And I trust that graduate educators are very interested in that. We have so many great trainers in our country who are really working hard on this. But more emphasis in some of these soft skills and in mental and behavioral health provision. I think those would be my top ones that I believe could use a little bit more emphasis if possible.
Thank you so much for sharing your experiences and sharing your wisdom.
I'm so honored that you contacted me, and it's been such a pleasure talking with you today. So thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to The Leitner Side of Things. If you have any feedback or topic ideas, let me know on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @SGERA99. See you at the next episode.